The following is a special presentation of Tony Curry Radio. Keep your mission on your mind, and your mind on your mission. This is Mission Minded with Michael Coleman.
Welcome to another edition of Mission Minded. We keep your mind on your mission on your mind. He's Michael Coleman. He's an expert and has worked in and with non-for-profits his entire life. Michael, what's going on, brother? How are you?
Fantastic. Always excited to talk about the nonprofit world and the business world, and with the idea of maybe helping some people along the way to navigate the space that they're in and make their lives better.
There you go. And you can hear the show live, of course, every Wednesday right here on Tony Curry Radio. We play it live twice. And better yet, you can also go to Spotify, search Tony Curry Radio, that's Curry with a K, K-U-R-R-E, or just search Mission Minded with Michael Coleman, and you can listen to a bunch of previous episodes. We've gotten into a lot of stuff, but one thing we have never, we've never done here, Michael, is we've taken emails. You go to TonyCurryRadio.net, and of course, we'll drop your emails, become a bonehead, and we'll read your emails here on Mission Minded. So Lucy in Huntsville wants to start a non-for-profit. She has heard us in the previous meetings and shows about board members. She wants to know the whole gamut on board members. When do you need to have board members? How many board members should you have? Who should they be? Should they be family members? Should they be people that are interested in the non-for-profit itself? Do they get paid? How often do they meet? And she also wants to know about the $50,000 threshold that the IRS takes a look at when it comes for non-for-profit. So a lot to tackle there. Where do you want to go?
Well, I could spend the whole show just on talking about answering that question. So let me start this way. I have been where she is. When I started, I knew by law that when you start a nonprofit, you have to have a minimum of 3 board members. Okay. But I didn't really know what a board member did other than, of course, that they oversaw some aspect of the organization. So I ended up going to about 5 of the closest people that I knew and explained my idea to them, explained my business plan to them, explained what impact I wanted to make in the community, and shared that vision with them. And those who I felt like could bring something to the table that were equally passionate or at least were very interested in helping me move this idea forward were people that I wanted to bring in, people that I trusted. Now, what was interesting that I found out was, even though I had some wonderful friends who came alongside of me and supported me, at that time, it was really a good choice because we were doing our bylaws and doing all our policy letters, and these were all people who were dot the I and cross the T people. Yeah. And that's not my strength. My strength is more in the big ideas and vision casting and those kind of things. And so I can do it when I have to, but it's just not my strength. So I surrounded myself with people who were supplementing for my weaknesses. Now, here's where later on down the line, it became a little problematic because as wonderful as these people were, I really didn't understand the importance of the fundraising aspect and their influence in the community that I've since grown to learn and appreciate. And so that's a different animal altogether. So the role, I will tell you, the role of a board member by law is to ensure that the organization operates within the framework of its mission statement, that it maintains this fiduciary responsibility to make sure that behind the scenes, all of those things are happening, the money's being managed, and they actually take on a legal liability. I mean, the board can be sued along with the organization. So it is a job to be taken very seriously. However, what you ultimately it may not be written in any sort of regulation, but when people say, what makes a good board member? I'll tell you 2 things, influence or affluence. And so what you want is you want board people, obviously, to financially support you and to invest of their own means. And so you'll have some people sometimes that can write huge check, but but maybe they can't write a big check. Maybe they have, they're still raising their kids. Maybe they're a little bit on the younger side. They still haven't, they don't have all that disposable income. And so you're like, okay, well, what are they bringing to the table in which they can't? So they might have a specialty. For instance, they might be an accountant just starting out. And so they might be somebody that's your treasurer on your board, and they can utilize those special skills. But when I talk about influence or affluence, what I expect out of a board member is, if when I invite somebody on, I want to know, okay, maybe you can write a big check. And if you can, that's certainly needed. But if you can't write a big check, can you introduce me? Do you have the influence? Can you call people or text people and get me in front of them? So in other words, you don't have to sell the vision of the organization as a board member. I will do that. But what I need is for you to open up doors with people that trust you, and in essence, parlay that trust to me. And initially, I didn't understand that. I didn't appreciate that. I didn't really get it. But as time went on, I began to find that I have board members who may want to just get it on their resume. You have all sorts of motives, good and bad, as to why somebody wants to serve. So I would just really encourage you to vet your board members, make sure they're interested. I would require all board members to financially participate, although I wouldn't necessarily set a limit, although some organizations do. But I would make sure that they're invested enough. Otherwise, you as the director will be chasing down these board members, and there will be nothing but a headache to you along the way.
Now, typically, and again, every non-for-profit is different, but typically, how often do board members meet?
Well, they're required by law, if I'm not mistaken, to meet at least quarterly.
Okay.
Now, this last set of board members that I had met monthly. You'll have some that meet quarterly, but then have like committees who meet between the actual meetings. So I've seen it shaped and built out all sorts of different ways. The challenge for me was because I am somebody who's very progressive in wanting to move the organization forward. So with organizations that are pretty stagnant, you know, it's not a big deal to meet every quarter because you really don't have a lot of new business. But I needed answers almost weekly of things I was adding, new collaborations, things I wanted the board to know, decisions I needed them to make. And so by the time I could get that in front of them at the board meeting, then they'd say, okay, we have to think about it. They'll give me an answer at the next board meeting. Well, that's 90 days from now. And yeah. And we had moved on. I mean, I needed a board that was more responsive, who could handle things in a more timely manner.
And I think it's
go ahead.
No, I think it's important too, because I mean, I've been asked to be a board member a couple of times because I have a son who's got special needs, and he's utilized a lot of other different non-for-profits to increase the happiness in his life. And because of that, people have asked me to be on their board, and I've been a little resistant to that because I wasn't sure exactly how much time was what it was going to take to make that happen. And I believed in what they were doing, but I could not commit to the time because I wasn't. So as a person who's asked to be on a board, what are some of the questions that you would ask a non-for-profit? Just ask them, how much time is it going to take or whatever? Because I think a lot of people think just being on a board, you show up once a month and you just vote on some things and you go home. And it's just not the case.
It's not. And the best board members do ask that question. Number one is that, what's the financial requirement? And lots of times I'll say, well, there's no specific amount, but it is asked that you financially support that, whatever that is. And then they say, you know, what's the time requirement? Because everybody's life is so busy, and I totally get it. That's why if you don't get somebody who is passionate about the subject, is not connected to them in some way, then it's very difficult to get them committed, because if they're passionate about it, they'll show up because they care.
Yeah.
If they're doing it just because it's a nice to have on my resume kind of thing, and I like the organization, but you know, you may not be passionate about it, then it's a lot harder getting them involved. I will even tell you that some of the huge mistakes that I've seen in boards is just, hey, you want to get, as an executive director, you want to get people who just agree with you. And you're going to have conflict with certain board members just because you've got a room full of different personalities. Some are going to be very risk averse. Others are going to be very bold. Some are going to want to take chances. Some are just, hey, let's make sure we're doing all this right. So you're going to be the rudder that guides that ship, and you should have the most influential, even though executive directors are not board members and they shouldn't be voting because it's a conflict of interest. You're turning over the ultimate decision-making authority to people who ultimately affect something that you're trying to drive. And so it can be very, very difficult. And I will be honest that I've had struggles at times with board members. Some I inherited, some I asked them. It's been the exception and not the rule in my life. But sometimes when I'm very passionate about something and I clearly see a direction and I'm supposed to be the expert in this area, you will have people who are non-experts who don't have the background, and yet they're the ones that are entrusted with the decisions. And so the best equivalent I could have is, let's say I was running a medical office and the doctor, who's the expert, says, well, I'm going to do this procedure, and I'm coming in from an admin and go, I don't think that's wise. I don't think you should do that. And you can imagine the frustration that a doctor would feel when he's like, no, I know what I'm doing.
Yeah.
And you just get some of that. And that's just the nature of the beast. So you want to really, if I had it to all do over again, I would have really spent a lot of time learning about the role of board members, making sure my board members were properly trained, that they understood the mission. I've even been a part of an organization who their primary focus was diversity of board. Now, I'm a huge fan of diversity, but if you only focus on racial diversity and not focused on intellectual diversity, then that becomes problematic, because what you're trying to do is present, yeah, we're open to all people, but you, in an effort to do that, you may not select the best board member out there. And that was always my contention. Look, I want a nice diversity across my board of men and women, people of all varying races. But I don't want unity of thought in their background. You know, I would rather have people who could bring different experiences, different perspectives, different career fields and to the table. So that's the diversity I would encourage people to pursue, is not diversity based on skin color, but diversity based on their experience and what they were bringing to the table.
He's Michael Coleman. He's an expert in the non-for-profit business world, and he does a show every single week called Mission Minded. We do it right here live every Wednesday. You can hear the show at least twice every Wednesday live, and of course, go back and listen to all of our previous episodes on Spotify at Tony Curry Radio. Just search Tony Curry Radio. You'll see Mission Minded. It's got a couple puzzle pieces. It's a great graphic. Check it out with Michael Coleman. You can listen to all of our previous episodes. So to further Lucy's point, there's a lot of non-for-profits that obviously don't make millions and millions of dollars every single year for whatever their non-for-profit or whatever their purpose is. And so that threshold of $50,000, how does that play in the IRS? And second of all, what are the advantages and disadvantages then to perhaps just do a fundraiser for something you believe in when there's already a non-for-profit for it, as opposed to taking it on yourself?
So to answer Lucy's question, I would need a little bit more context on the $50,000. I'm not sure. I didn't encounter that when I started a nonprofit, and that specific number hasn't come up. So I would need to do a little bit more research on that.
I think what she's talking about is, I think anything under $50,000, if you're bringing in less than $50,000, you don't have to go through tax preparation or at least report that. I think that's how it worked with the Bright House Foundation anyway, because we never got quite to that threshold, but I think that's what she was talking about.
Oh, I got you. Yes. Okay. I understand. So yeah, there are IRS reporting requirements that annually you have to do a 990. And so it may be that if it's under that threshold, you would not have to do that paperwork. And I will tell you, a 990 is significant. But also when people look to your organization, it is a public document that declares who's on your board, who your top executives are, what their salaries are. what the purpose is, what the results are. So it is a very important document. As a matter of fact, it's so important that the IRS came out probably 15 years ago and stated that for those organizations who did not, who went more than, I think, three, who didn't file a 990 within a three-year period, would have their exemption, tax exemption removed, and would no longer be recognized by the IRS as a nonprofit. So yep. It's a big deal to get that done and to manage that effectively.
All right, Lily in Birmingham, and you're listening to Mission Minded with Michael Coleman. He's an expert in the non-for-profit business world. And, of course, we keep your mind, your mission, and your mind. You can hear it live right here on Tony Curry Radio and also on Spotify. Search Tony Curry Radio and Mission Minded. You can listen to all the shows free. Lily in Birmingham, this is an interesting question. She said, how do companies acknowledge paying some of their members or their board members, I guess, so much? Is it okay to pay someone, for example, $100,000, if they're bringing in a lot more than that into the organization, and how does the public perceive that?
Hey, that's a great question. Mm-hmm. Usually I will tell you in the nonprofit world that you see the average nonprofit does not pay its board of directors. So they understand, hey, this is a service that I'm giving. I'm using my leadership experience and my influence in any given community to better the mission of this organization. And so if you look on any 990, it lists every single board member, and it tells you about how many hours per week that they have to dedicate to the organization. And usually you'll see one. So usually an hour a week is what they're spending towards that organization. But that all that has to be annotated. And if they're paid anything, that has to be recognized. You just typically do not see that in the true nonprofit world. Now, what you see lots of times are corporate boards that are not necessarily that are run by board of directors, and they want influential people, and they are paid huge sums of money. Or maybe your larger, national and international nonprofits, you want to get the movers and shakers out there, so they may offer them salaries. But that's really not something that the average nonprofit who's in your community and providing services. I remember, for example, they talk about people in government, and you may not be making huge sums of money, but I remember when Colin Powell went back to civilian life from his government days. He retired from the military and, you know, Secretary of Defense, all that kind of stuff. Secretary of State. But he was on several boards and paid huge sums of money. Why? Because he was admired, he was recognized, and he brought influence and support to that organization. At the smaller level, you're not going to see that. You're not going to see now. Jimmy Hale, it is the largest local nonprofit in the city. We don't pay our board of directors. And so that's just not the norm with service providers. You get up into the big things like Red Cross and international programs like that. That's where you're likely to come across that problem.
There you go. Hank in Nashville wants to know, what's the best way to attract brand new donors through advertising? Does radio work? Does TV work? Do billboards work? And his big question is, do mailers work when it comes to attracting new donors? And of course, I've gotten a lot of things in the mail. And it's funny because once you start giving to one organization, you start getting mailers from everybody, which is how it works. But through your years of service, what do you find works best?
That's a fantastic question. And the answer is all the above and none of the above. So it's not necessarily the method by which you use. For instance, let me explain. So I could send out a mailer just a bland mailer. And let's say I sent it to 10,000 people in Birmingham who had never heard of the Jimmy Hale Mission. And it was just, hey, here's what we do. But if I sent out a flyer that shows somebody's life is transformed, in other words, I'm not just telling you about the organization. I'm showing you the impact on the community. So it's all about the messaging and much less about the way you contact them. So I've done radio. I've done TV. I've done direct mail. I've done, billboards. I've done everything there is to do. And it's more about the messaging and how to bring this synergistic effort between all of those mediums to be able to get across your message. The bottom line is the donor has to view what you're doing as making a true impact on their community, and that it's that you're involved in changing lives, and it's something that they are willing to give their hard-earned money for to support. In other words, it speaks to one of their core values. And so you have to be able to link the values of what you're doing and why you're doing it and connect with their heart, because where somebody's heart is, the money's going to follow. And so that's it's just vital to understand. Now, I will tell you this as well. There is absolutely no doubt in today's world that if I was going after 20 and 30 and 40-year-olds, it wouldn't be through direct mail. Why? Because many of them don't even check their physical mail. Yeah. Everything is electronic. All their bills, they pay their bills online. But the 50, 60, 70, 80-year-old donors still write a check. They still read all the stuff in the mail because they have a lot more time with their life. They've raised their kids, their grandkids. So you send them a flyer, they'll read every bit of it. So when we send out our bulletins, we don't just ask for money. We're like, hey, here's what's going on, and we're inviting you to be a part of this dynamic, life-changing program. And so we get new donors all the time, some from our radio, some from our TV, some from our online advertising, social media advertising. So don't focus so much on the medium as focus on your market. If you're going for younger crowd, you would want to stay more digital. Going for the older crowd, they're less digital and more of the TV maybe, or more of the radio, things like that. But without an impactful statement of the difference that you're making, you're not going to have as great a success regardless of what medium you choose to deliver that message.
It's a great show called Mission Minded with Michael Coleman. He's an expert in the field. He's worked in and with the non-for-profits his entire career. And of course, we're taking your emails at TonyCurryRadio.net, TonyCurryRadio.net. Become a bonehead to drop your emails. And of course, you can hear the show every Wednesday twice right here on Tony Curry Radio Live and also on Spotify. Search Spotify and look for Tony Curry Radio and the Mission Minded. You got it. Tom in Birmingham, this will be our final email. It's a great question. He said, what would Michael do if his biggest donor started showing up to meetings and trying to influence how things were working in our non-for-profit? Sticky situation there. I've seen this happen in athletics a lot when you have boosters. And we know that at Auburn and Alabama and wherever you have big time athletic boosters, sometimes they do influence the things that are built and made and done in an athletic institution. But this is a little different for non-for-profit. So how do you deal with that? Do you have a sit down with them first? Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. So I will give you a generic, and then I'll give you a real life case that recently happened to me.
Okay.
So let's say I have a $1 million donor. And so it's a lot of money. And with that, somebody who gives $1 million, just like they give to the sports programs, they expect to have a voice. And so I would give an extra amount of my time. I would do everything I could to appease them, with the exception of changing what I knew to be right. So let me give you a true story that I had. I had a pledge for some reconstruction work that we were doing. And he wanted some input on the design, but the input he gave was very good. So I adopted it and I praised him for it. Let's say it wasn't good, then I would have to explain to him or her that why it was not a good fit. And so you have to stand up to that person. And if it came to the point to where somebody says, well, you either do it my way or the highway, I would choose the highway, because once you're beholden to somebody and once that their influence causes you to go adrift of what you know is right, then that's going to serve you. That's going to be problematic for the rest of your existence there. But this is actually a story that does have. There was a gentleman who wrote us a $10,000 check every year. But he was getting up in age, and he was really, we were a faith-based organization, or a faith-based organization, and was very concerned that we were not portraying our faith correctly. And so we engaged him, but it got to the point he was harassing my staff. And so he would not talk with me. He wanted to just talk with my staff, and it almost came across as bullying.
Yeah.
And so I engaged him through an email and asked to meet with him. You know, that didn't go anywhere. So I sent him an email and said he was a local doctor, and obviously won't call his name. But I said, listen, you have been such a great supporter over the years, and we have valued your input, and I would like for it to continue. However, I can no longer allow you to bully my staff and to inject your view on what we should be. If that continues, I would encourage you to take your support and support another worthy organization. I hope you'll stay. I hope you'll choose to stay with us. But if not, I just wish you all the best moving forward. And that was the choice that I made. And it's one of those to where it was, I knew that in my heart it was the right thing to do, and I could not compromise who I was or the organization that I was leading for the sake of dollars. Because once you give that up, you'll never get it back again.
And how'd it work out?
Well, his year-long contribution is coming up, so we'll see if he chooses to renew. But here's the other thing. In my heart, I can rest at night knowing that I stood on principle, that I always try to find accommodations, knowing that you have some very eccentric people who are used to getting in their way. And so I listen, I try to inform, I try to bring them along. I try to just bring them in the process. But at the end of the day, I cannot let an outside person govern our mission, because it interferes with the board's role, it interferes with my role, and it interferes with me doing what I know is the right thing to do. And so if I have to waive large donors, if I have to push them aside for the good of the mission, ultimately it serves my clients to do so.
Amen, brother. Michael Coleman, another edition of Mission Minded. Again, you can hear it live every Wednesday right here on Tony Curry Radio. We play it for you live, and you'll hear the first one. And then, of course, if you want to go back and listen to any of the previous episodes, and we've gotten into mission statements, we've gotten some really, really good stuff. And finally, some emails here. Keep those emails coming, TonyCurryRadio.net, TonyCurryRadio.net. Become a bonehead and just drop a line, and we'll read some more of those again next week. Michael, thank you so much, brother. We'll look forward to catching with you next Wednesday.
Hey, Tony, let me say, I am so thankful for those listeners out there and for those emails. And so I really appreciate their time. And just please continue to keep them coming. I love it, because I know that you're battling those real world things. And if there's anything Tony and I can bring to the table to help you navigate that, man, that's what we're here for. So thank you.
This has been a special presentation of Tony Curry Radio.